And I believe that we need more effective diplomacy to get our European allies, the Canadians and the others, to join with us in the economic blockade of Cuba.
Mr. Nixon, you mentioned in your speech that time is against us. How much time do we have to win the war in Vietnam?
In my view, an effective military, economic, and diplomatic offensive directed toward the objective of a military, economic, and diplomatic quarantine of North Vietnam could bring the war to an end within a matter of 2 years. I believe that that should be U.S. policy, and I believe that 2 years is as much time as the United States might have. That does not mean that the war could not be ended sooner than that. I am simply suggesting that letting the war drag on longer than 2 years or 3 years, I think, would run a very grave risk of escalation. All of this talk about escalation, you see, I think, turns the question completely around. Because when individuals talk about the dangers of escalating by doing what is necessary to shorten the war, they overlook the much greater danger of escalating if we allow the war to drag on. If this war drags on for 4-5 years, we're going to look communist China's nuclear power, much less than ours, but from a nation much less concerned about destruction of human life than the United States, we're going to be looking it right in the face. And either the possibilities of World War III would be increased, or the possibilities of diplomatic blackmail would become irresistible.
I'll consolidate about 3 questions in this question. They're all concerning California. Since you are a native of California and did represent California in Congress and were a candidate for the governor, what is your opinion of Ronald Reagan? What do you think of his 10% cuts in the university system? And what do you think of the firing of President Kerr of Berkeley?
All I can say is I'm probably fortunate I wasn't elected governor of California. Seriously, on all of these questions. First, I think Ronald Reagan will again confound his critics, as he did in his campaign, by being an effective governor of California and one who will, by comparison with his predecessor, make a record which will win him re-election to governor if he decides to run for governor again, or would perhaps result in his being considered for national office if that should turn out to be his desire. Second, as far as the university budget is concerned, I would not presume to try to comment upon it from this distance. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't presume to comment on the budget of the University of Florida, as close as I am to it here. I do believe this, however. California faces a financial crisis of immense magnitude. It's a crisis that is the result of Governor Brown and his administration's failing to deal with this problem over the past 4 years. Governor Reagan has the unpleasant task of trying to find the money to continue California's very fine tradition in higher education, and yet at the same time not bankrupt the state. My own view is that it is much too early to judge, as some have been judging, his cut of 10%. As I've read the most recent news stories, the cut is not one that is to be applied immediately. It is one that is to be applied with discrimination in certain areas, and it is also one in which the governor has indicated that he has an open mind in his discussions with the regents as to what modifications could be made to accomplish the objective of continuing a fine university system and at the same time financing it adequately from state revenues. Now, with regard to the firing of the chancellor of the university is concerned, I am not going to enter into that particular controversy. I would say that this is a question of in which the chancellor of the university and the new governor of California, if they reach an impasse, then the governor of California, as the elected representative of the people, must, of course, take precedence. And he must take precedence, and if the chancellor of the university does not feel that he can abide that he can live with the man who has been elected by an overwhelming majority of the people, then he should find another position, and it would be necessary for the governor to find somebody who can work with him. Let us remember one thing. Education basically is something very close to our hearts. As a Californian who grew up in this great free education system, and it is a great system, and it is one that other states now are following, I think, to their credit. Education is something that we therefore not only pay lip service to, but it has become virtually a sacred cow. But on the other hand, education too must, insofar as its budget is concerned, insofar as its efficiency is concerned, must meet certain standards. And when a great state like California or Florida have financial problems, the educators must work with the people's elected representatives in finding solutions to these problems. Yes, sir.
The question is, do you believe the 18-year-old should be allowed to vote?
Yes. Even if it helps Bobby Kennedy, I'm for it. But I'm for it for a reason, however, which I think should be put in perspective. I think it's nonsense to say that a man that's old enough to vote to fight is old enough to vote. That's beside the point. Some who are old enough to fight or able enough to fight may not have the intelligence to vote. The reason that 18-year-olds, I believe, should be granted the privilege of voting is that they're smart enough to vote. Now, I'm not trying to butter up this audience when I say that I thought I had a pretty good education back in the 30s. But today, America's young people, and I will include high school in this as well as college and university, are better educated, they're more sophisticated, they know more about the world, they know more about political affairs in the United States than the previous generation or any previous generation in this history. Let me say this is not limited to the United States. I spoke recently last August at the University of Malaysia, and I was tremendously impressed by the interest and the intelligence, the imagination of these young students. People who therefore have had the benefits of being exposed to a superior educational system have acquired the intelligence which a mass electorate can well use at this point. I think 18-year-olds may lack judgment in some respect, 18, 19, and 20. As a matter of fact, I can say that people over 21 sometimes can be wrong, at least as far as I'm concerned. But nevertheless, I do feel that on this particular item, that the whole issue should be kept in perspective. And the issue is, would it mean that the electorate would gain in intelligence, in diversity, in understanding by adding 18-year-olds to the electorate? And I believe it would.
In view of the present power struggle in Red China, do you feel that we should allow the national Chinese to invade the mainland and liberate their own country?
When we talk about the nationalist Chinese, our allowing the nationalist Chinese to invade the mainland, I think all of us realize, those who are sophisticated in this field, that the United States is not going to participate in any action which could provoke a bloodbath in that part of the world, and which might in addition to that, bring about a struggle which could expand throughout the whole Asian hemisphere. I would answer your question in this way. If the Chinese communists overtly intervene in Vietnam, if the Chinese communists do as they did in Korea, and there, as you know, in addition to sending in supplies, they sent 50,000 to 100,000 men into the struggle, or more. If that happens any place in the world, then I believe that the United States and the Chinese nationalists would be justified in seeing that that power, which is there next to the mainland, be used against Communist China. But if Communist China does not intervene, in other words, if that kind of provocation does not occur, I do not believe there could be justification for the United States, in effect, supporting what would be interpreted throughout the world as being a war of aggression because we began it.
Mr. Yes, Nixon, sir. This questioner would like to know what opinion you have on what side and position the United States should take in case of war between the Arab countries and Israel.
Well, I think what the United States should do with regard to the war between the Arab countries and Israel and between India and Pakistan and all of the other areas of the world is to take no side. It's absolutely ridiculous for the countries in the Mideast, for India and Pakistan and others to be talking about fighting each other. Visit those countries. I'm not speaking of Israel, which basically is much richer and stronger than the others, but when you see the poverty of the Mideast, when you see the terrible poverty of India and Pakistan, and you've never seen it till you've been to India and Pakistan, really, when you see that, all that I can say is that under those circumstances, the United States should use its diplomatic and economic and military power to the greatest extent possible for the purpose of first preventing war, and if it should come, God forbid, if it should come, to use it to bring it to an end without siding with either one.
Mr. Nixon, do you support the U.S.'s action in supporting Britain against Rhodesia in lieu of Britain's attitude towards us in Vietnam or otherwise?
The British attitude toward the United States in Vietnam and the British attitude toward the United States in Cuba, as I inferred earlier, is one that is not particularly pleasing to most Americans and not to me. I respect the British as a great people, their institutions, which of course are the predecessors to ours. But under the circumstances that I previously have described, it would certainly seem that Britain could at least avoid helping potential enemies of the United States, to wit, Cuba, and Britain should use her diplomatic power, as we use ours, to avoid any assistance to Vietnam. Let me say in fairness on the latter point that while at an earlier stage in this war, British ships, directly or indirectly or through subterfuge, were hauling great quantities of materials into North Vietnam, that much of that, or practically all of that traffic, has stopped. I think the same should happen with regard to Cuba. The other side of the coin, of course, is that Britain does not help us fight the enemy in Vietnam, and that, of course, is a decision that they make based on their own very different evaluation of the stakes that are involved. Now let's look at Rhodesia. It seems to me that when we look at our problems around the world, that if we're going to have a force for peace in the world that will be effective, the key to that is cooperation between the European countries and the United States of America. That cooperation has been greatly strained by the British attitude and the French attitude and other attitudes against toward the United States insofar as Vietnam and Cuba are concerned. But I don't think that the other side of that coin is for the United States to say that we will reject the request of the British to support their decision with regard to a nation within their sphere of influence, and that nation is Rhodesia. We can argue about what should happen in Rhodesia, but I think that what should control the decision is an issue more important than the differences between Rhodesia and Britain. And that issue is, how can we establish better communication and better cooperation between the United States, Britain, and the other great nations in the European complex? And for the United States to go against Britain on Rhodesia would only serve to break down that great alliance even more. I think we have to put British-American relations above that, and for that reason, I would support Britain on its Rhodesian question, clearly apart from what the merits of that might be. And I would think that they, as a quid pro quo, should support us when we make a decision, as we did in Vietnam and with regard to Cuba. I think, in other words, our diplomacy suffers at the present time from being a one-way street. If we help other nations, our great allies, in their foreign policy decisions, which they believe are best for them and for the cause of freedom and peace in the world, then certainly the least we can ask is that they support us. And I would hope that in the years ahead, this administration, with some goading from the loyal opposition, which the Republicans will now give them, can establish more of that quid pro quo with our European allies and other nations that we have aided throughout the world.
Here's another question on Red China. Do you expect a major shift in U.S.-Red-Chinese relations before 1970?
I don't expect a major shift in U.S. and Red Chinese relations before 1970, but I would suggest this. We happen to be at a great turning point in history, a great turning point, the axis of which is this miserable, difficult war in Vietnam. If that war is brought to a successful conclusion, and by a successful conclusion, I do not mean the destruction of North Vietnam, but I mean the defeat of communist aggression in South Vietnam and the guarantee of the independence of South Vietnam. If that war is brought to a conclusion before 1970, then I believe that the way will be opened for a dialogue with communist China. Because then China, communist China, will have, I hope and I believe, learned the lesson that the Soviet Union learned in a very different context in the Cuban confrontation. What I am suggesting is this. Vietnam obsesses us today because of its difficulty and because of its controversy. But if we can see our way clear to develop the new policies which will bring the war to an end, bring it to an end successfully, militarily, and by more military pressure, I believe, accelerate the possibilities of any kind of diplomatic ending of the war. If we bring that to a war, that is the condition precedent to any change in our relations with China. The other side of the coin is this. I know there are those who say, why don't we admit Red China to the United Nations today? Because it is your enemies you should talk to. More important that you communicate with them than with your friends. Why don't we, some even suggest, recognize Red China? Not on the basis that the United States should look to the legality or morality of a government, but on the old basis, which the British have always followed, that if a government's in, then you recognize it. And the answer is that the United States, in my opinion, could make no greater mistake than to change its policy toward Red China at a time when Red China is openly aggressive against the United States. It's an aggressor against the United States in Korea, it threatens Taiwan, and it is supporting and aiding and instigating an enemy of the United States in Vietnam. Until Red China, therefore, ceases that aggression, or until that aggression is brought to a conclusion, I do not believe you can have a change in the U.S. attitude toward Red China. And until our attitude changes, theirs will not.
You speak of the slow dissolution of NATO. Do you feel that the basic premises upon which that organization was founded are somewhat outdated in respect to the political changes in the last 20 years?
No question about it. The difficulty with American foreign policy today, and of course it's easy to sit here in an armchair and criticize those who are conducting the battle, but that's one of the luxuries you have when you are not in power. But the difficulty with our foreign policy today is that too many of our policies are based on conditions that existed 20 years ago when the policies were made, and the policies have not been modified to meet those conditions. I was there, traveled all through Europe in 1947 as a member of the Herder Committee when we developed the Marshall Plan. It was a good plan. It was the right plan. NATO was the right military plan for that time. But look at the Europe of 1947, 20 years ago, or at the Europe 10 years ago. 15 years ago. Europe was weak economically. It was therefore weak politically. Europe was on its back, unable to defend itself, and therefore Europe had to say to the United States, you are in the driver's seat, and let us set up some kind of an arrangement where the United States, in effect, calls the turn. Now, what has happened today? There's a tendency in some diplomatic quarters, well-intentioned, I know, to say, well, the fellow that is at fault here is de Gaulle. Now, if de Gaulle were only to go leave the scene, we'd have no problems as far as NATO and Europe was concerned. That's just nonsense. Sure, de Gaulle is very difficult, but he is only, in my opinion, he's only the more virulent of example of a condition that exists in varying degrees all over Europe today. Because France today is no longer weak economically, it's strong. France has some nuclear capability. All of the European nations now are on their feet economically and they're feeling their oats politically and diplomatically. And so you need a new arrangement which will take into account the new power of the European countries and recognize that the United States can no longer and should no longer insist upon an outmoded formula which fitted a situation 20 years ago, but does not fit it today. I think, as a matter of fact, Vietnam, of course, is important, and our relations with China, all these other parts of the world. But if I were to pick one diplomatic area of prime importance for the year 1967 and for the year 1968, it is the development of new programs and new policies to establish cooperation militarily, economically, diplomatically between the European-American community. Let us remember that when Europe goes one way and America goes the other, it makes it very difficult for any of us to carry out policy. Britain would have a terribly difficult time, more difficult than it's presently having vis-a-vis Rhodesia, if the United States had not supported it. And by the same token, let's look at Cuba. If today we could get the cooperation of our European allies, rather than their open defiance of our economic boycott, then we could have a more effective policy of putting the economic squeeze on Castro and eventually bring about the conditions which would free that country. This is why of highest priority is to develop a new program toward Europe. I'm afraid not.
This question then, Mr. Nixon.
Do you want to pass it down? I'll be able to take it. Yes.
Would you give us your evaluation and reaction to Harrison Salisbury's reports from North Vietnam?
Harrison Salisbury, as most of you know who have followed these reports, is an expert on Soviet-American relations, an expert because certainly he had time to acquire that. He was in the Soviet Union when I was there in 1959. I respect him as a very astute and able observer of the international scene. I would only suggest this, that when a nation is at war, even a free nation, it is very difficult for any reporter to get a completely accurate picture of what is going on, because the national security must come first. When a communist nation is at war, that picture becomes, in my opinion, completely unbelievable. I think the difficulty with the Salisbury reports is that too often he, in reporting what he saw, was reporting also what they were showing him and what they wanted reported back in the United States. And as far as I'm concerned, I just don't think it makes sense, let me say. I don't think it makes sense when American men, 35,000 of them in the year 66, 35,000 of them killed, wounded, and missing, fighting an enemy in North Vietnam, in South Vietnam. I don't think it makes sense to have reporters go to North Vietnam and to send the enemy propaganda back to the United States of America.
Mr. Nixon has exceeded his questioning time by half an hour, and we're certainly very grateful for his time. He has a very tight schedule to meet tonight, and so we're going to ask that you hurry on over to the Student Service Center as we have a reception set up with a receiving line, and we hope that he will have an opportunity to meet as many of you personally as possible. Thank you so much for your participation, and Mr. Nixon, we certainly thank you.